You are our third case of the day and our sixth of the term so far this year, and we're most happy to see you. Before I begin, is your client's name Mayday or Mayday, or how shall we pronounce it? We've had a discussion about which is proper. Mayday. All right, very good. Yes, I figured that, but we probably will call it Mr. Mayday then. All right. Very good. Are you both prepared to proceed? Okay, State versus Mayday, and off you go. We divided 4-3 on the pronunciation.
May it please the Court, I am Tom Ballastrieri, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this case. This is a case that involves a recurring question. It keeps coming up time and time and time again, not only in this court, not only in the Court of Appeals in this state, but it keeps coming up all over the country where courts have this vouching rule. This is a rule that is very easy to state. It's not that easy to apply. The rule is very simple. No witness should be permitted to testify that another witness is telling the truth. Easy to state. But when does a witness testify that another witness is telling the truth? Certainly if the first witness gets up and says, "Yes, I believe that the child," let's call it the child in this case because it's easier than talking about two different witnesses. "Yes, I believe that the child is telling the truth when she says she is sexually assaulted." That's an easy case. But what happens when you get to situations where the witness doesn't say that? What happens when you have a situation like this case where you have a social worker who conducted an examination, an interview of the child, and testifies at the trial, "I saw no indication that the child had been coached. I saw no indication that the child was not telling the truth."
Well, what's the foundation for those conclusions? What is the foundation in this case?
If you're
record?
Asking what is the foundation in this case?
In this case.
There wasn't very much of a foundation.
That's right. And why isn't it easy to apply the rule that if you are going to, say, draw a conclusion about coaching or draw a conclusion about the truthfulness, that you give the criteria that a witness would use, and the criteria for coaching are, that's the foundation we're talking about, and then the witness does or does not comply with those criteria. And the same thing about truthfulness. So it's easy to say, and I don't disagree with you, that it's easy to state the rule, you can't testify to truthfulness, but it's not easy to apply. You could say that about any rule in the law. It's easy to state, hard to apply. Some rules are not even easy to state, but if it's easy to state, it may be hard to apply. Why can't you just say there was no foundation? You got to have a foundation, then it's easy to apply.
Well, because the general rule is that an expert witness doesn't have to state the facts or data on which they rely before they're permitted to give an opinion.
Until Daubert. I mean, that is the maxim, right? I mean, would you have an opinion to the reasonable qualifications? You have a reasonable opinion to a reasonable medical probability or whatever the standard's going to be. Yes, I have an opinion. What is it? Bum, bum, bum. And that's all you have to ask. But I think we're in a different world.
No, we're not.
Okay.
Because there are two different worlds. Daubert is a different world than the trial. Daubert is a preliminary question of admissibility, of reliability.
But it applies to trials.
It applies at a trial.
Right.
But it's a question that's decided by the judge, by the court.
Right.
It's not a question that's presented for the jury. So the prosecutor or whoever, the proponent of the evidence,
yeah. This
has
is not
to
a Daubert case.
I'm sorry?
No one objected to this testimony on Daubert.
That's right.
Grounds. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
Nobody is challenging this on Daubert grounds.
No, one challenged it on
but
Daubert.
But the concept of reliability is in Daubert, and it is here, too.
But my point in answer to Justice Bradley's question is that Daubert relates to a preliminary question that's decided by the judge. The judge has to determine from paper or from whatever that the witness basically is giving testimony that actually qualifies as expert testimony. I'll use that as a shorthand. But once you get to the evidentiary portion of the trial, once you get to the point where the expert is actually testifying, then all of that reliability business kind of drops out, and the rule of evidence for when the expert is actually testifying is that the expert does not have to state the facts or data. Now, that can be inquired into either by the proponent or by the opponent of the evidence, but that's not a predicate for...
But there's an exception if they're going to testify as to coaching or credibility.
Well, I...
What the cases say.
The cases say, and I think this is critical, the cases say that you can get in evidence on coaching in situations where the predicate has been laid.
Mm-hmm.
None of those cases, as I read them, says you can only get it in if you lay that predicate.
But
that's that's a whole different story.
You're saying you can get it in even though there's not a predicate.
Under the rules of evidence, yes. Now that may be one of the things that this court might want to decide in this case. You might want to say this is an exception to that general rule of evidence on expert testimony. Although we do not generally require that the expert testify to the reasons that the expert has come to a particular conclusion, while that may be the general rule, we're going to say that when you testify as to coaching, then you have to lay that foundation. But that's something that has yet to be decided.
Well, you see, the way I see the cases, that is decided.
I'm sorry?
The way I read these cases, it is decided.
That's
the special rule for the credibility in coaching, and it overtakes any general rule you want to say about expert witnesses.
Well, I think you're reading more into these cases than is actually
Pardon
there.
Me?
I think you are reading more into these cases than is actually there. I think what you're saying is these cases have all been in situations where there has been some kind of a predicate laid, and that the courts have ruled that where there is this predicate, then you can come to the conclusion. I mean, I don't disagree with that. That's what these courts say. But they have never faced a situation like this, at least no case that I've found, has dealt with a situation like this where a specific predicate has not been laid. They've never said, although you can get it in when the predicate is laid, you can't get it in if it's not laid. I'm not aware of any case that says that.
But you have the general rule that they can't testify as to credibility. Can't say that, in my opinion, it's truthful. And
right.
That's the problem.
Right.
The problem here is that what the witness said can be easily interpreted by the jury as a testimony about credibility and about coaching. That's the point that I'm trying to make to you.
Mr. Balistrieri, I'm wondering if you might help me in applying Krueger and Jensen to this case. And the way I see this and where I can use your help is if Krueger and Jensen look like tiptoeing up to the line that divides the ban on testifying to another witness. Krueger, the question, the case, the court said the typical signs of whether a child has been coached or evidence of suggestibility of a complainant child exhibits such signs is admissible. And it sounds like the reason it was admissible is because it's not testifying to credibility, but testifying to observational things that could be used in determining credibility. State v. Jensen took one step closer to that, I think, and said that looking at a testimony that says this is consistent with sexual assault, a little closer to testifying directly to credibility, but still looking at separate activity indicia. And it looks like the rule is if you're talking about indicia, you're okay. If you're talking about the ultimate question of credibility, you're not. So in this case, it sounds like the question is going to come down to whether a witness says there are indications or lack thereof of honesty, whether that is whether that's closer to testimony that is similar to saying something is consistent with X, right? Or whether that's closer to simply opining on the ultimate question of credibility. So could you tell me where indication of dishonesty might fall in that continuum in leading up to that line?
Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with your premise. And what I would ask this court to do is draw a very clear line between testimony that's permissible and testimony that's not permissible. The line being between testimony that states an opinion, a personal opinion, about whether the witness is credible. That would be impermissible, as opposed to testimony that just says, I observed these things about the witness's behavior bearing on credibility. That would be permissible. That would be admissible. And I would like the court to draw that very clear line.
Say that again. I observed what? What can the witness say?
I observed these things about the child's behavior bearing on whether the child was credible when she was making these statements.
Are you asking for a special rule in child sexual
cases? Not necessarily a special rule in child cases, but I think the problem arises most frequently in child cases. It certainly does in this case, because what you have is a situation in child cases where you have a social worker or someone who does similar things who interviews the child and then is asked to testify about what the child said. We don't ordinarily do that with adult victims. We have a special rule for child victims in sexual assault cases. So that's where the problem arises, and that's where I'm trying to address it, is in that context where it frequently arises. Now, the second part of my answer to your question, Justice Kelly, is that I think that in this case, although absolutely everyone agrees, that the testimony that was elicited in this case was very close to the line. I mean, we've got a prosecutor, we've got a defense lawyer, we've got a circuit judge, all saying this was not vouching, and then the Court of Appeals comes back and says, no, this was vouching. So there certainly can be a difference of opinion. It's close to the line. But my position is that when a witness says there was no indication that the child was coached or was not telling the truth, the critical word is indication. It's what the witness, the social worker, saw. It's not her personal belief.
Okay, so let's assume that to be true. Do we need to look at how a reasonable jury is likely to interpret that? So in that context, is there a substantive difference between these statements? Quote, I saw no indication the witness was being dishonest, unquote, And this statement, quote, the witness was not dishonest, close quote. Is there a substantive difference between
those? Oh, I think there's a very clear substantive difference. And it's a difference between saw and was. And that is the social worker, and I'll use that term because I'm trying to avoid witness. The social worker's only talking about what the social worker observed. When she says the witness was, that's getting into an opinion.
Okay. And is a reasonable juror likely to hear the distinction between those two statements?
I think we can presume that they would, yes.
Yeah, see, that was going to be my question to him too, Justice Kelly. Do we look at the statement from the perspective of a reasonable juror, or those of us who are used to parsing words down to the T being crossed and the I being dotted? They may be two different standards.
That's possible, but then we have to assume that reasonable jurors are the same as reasonable judges, and we'll look at these things in a common sense way, giving words their ordinary meaning, and they're going to look at the word. Let's use the example in this case. They're going to look at the word indicate the way anyone would look at the word indicate, with that meaning, which is that it's simply a sign of something else. It's something that the social worker saw. It's not what she believes about the witness or about the child or about what the child said or about how the child said it. She's saying there was this indication, and indication is this is something I saw. So in this case, at least, I don't think there's any kind of a dichotomy or a distinction between what a reasonable jury would think and what a reasonable judge would think.
What is it that she saw?
I'm sorry?
What is it that she saw that led to her reasonable indication?
Well, this gets back to Justice Abraham's question about whether there was this foundation here. And I have to say that I don't know. The record doesn't tell us.
What about, as the Krieger case speaks of, the import of the aura of scientific reliability created by the expert witness, and that under the circumstances it creates too great of a possibility that it really usurps or causes the jury to abdicate, I guess is the word of Krieger, the determination of credibility. When you put that patina of expertise in fancy words.
You know, I've never bought that argument. I know it was made in Hazeltine. It's been repeated ever since. Mm-hmm. I've never bought it because I think it fails to give the jurors enough credit for being independent.
Except those cases limited to these circumstances. The circumstances is where it is a kind of a he said, she said, and that that was not corroborated by independent evidence. And as such, the issue at trial, the only issue at trial, is credibility, I think.
But that doesn't necessarily, just because the only issue is credibility, doesn't mean the jury is going to abdicate its function, which is what it is clearly told in the standard instructions. It's for them alone to decide credibility. I think this just fails to give jurors enough credit for following that instruction.
Could be, but what you're saying is contrary to the court's decision in Jensen, which I almost read verbatim, cited with authority by Krieger, which I did read close to verbatim. You may disagree with those court's pronouncements, but, okay.
But if you look at that statement, if you go back to the first time that statement is made, what authority is there for saying that? There is none. There has never been any authority cited. There have never been any scientific studies. There's never been any juror questionnaires. There's never been anything to support that view that jurors are going to abdicate their function as the finder of credibility just because some expert comes up and says, I think the child was credible.
Yeah,
now, at the very least.
The problem is, if I may, the problem is that they're not saying it does occur, but that it rises to such a level that essentially it undermines the confidence.
Okay, if you're going to say it rises to the level, then you have to look at more than just the fact that there's an expert who says, I believe the child is credible. And I want to make clear, I'm not conceding that in this case.
Do you want us to withdraw that language in Jensen and to withdraw that language in Krieger? And I don't know if it's in Hazleton, but to the extent that it is, do you want us to withdraw that language?
I think at the very least, it needs some explanation. At the very least, it is an oversimplification that just because an expert is going to say, I think the child is credible, that the jurors are just going to say, oh, yeah, well, the expert thinks she's credible, so we'll think she's credible. No, there's a lot of other things that go into it.
But the problem is, in this case, that's the only thing that went into it. It was a conclusory statement.
But you still have, I understand that we didn't have the foundation. I concede that. We don't have the foundation. It's not there. All right? But there's still a lot more things that go into it that you have to look at. And that's why I think that the statement is an oversimplification. You have to look at, A, of the qualifications of the expert. What kind of expert is there? You also have to look at the question of, why did the expert say this? You have to look at the question of, was the expert just talking about the expert's observation of the child during the interview, or is this a statement that applies to not just the child's testimony at the interview, but also at the trial? Also very important.
Counselor, before you go on, and your orange light is on, and I have a question I want to ask you.
Have you finished answering Justice Bradley?
I'm sorry?
Have you finished answering Justice
Bradley? I have not, but if...
No, you go ahead. I thought you were done.
There was just one other thing I wanted to add, and I think this is important, and that is whether the jurors have an opportunity to see the child making the statements both during the interview by means of a video recorded statement and at the trial, where they are able to, where they're able to make their own assessment. I think all of that has to go into the mix in trying to determine whether or not the jury is likely to abdicate their function or just say, oh, the expert says so, so we'll say so. It's not that simple an issue. It's been made to appear like a simple issue in some of these cases, but when you really think about it, it's not. I'm sorry.
There were two questions that were asked. One is, was there any indication that, and they have the initials for the witness, had been coached in any way during the interview? Answer, no. Second question, was there any indication that witness was not being honest during her interview with you? Answer again is no. Do you think these questions have to be considered together?
Yes,
or could
I do.
The court, well, you didn't let me
yes.
finish.
I'm sorry.
You probably knew what I was going to say, find that one was okay and the other was not okay, which
yes.
is what I was going to ask you. And you think, no, you have to consider them as a group.
Yes. If you consider them in the context of all of the questions that preceded these two, they were all about the question, they were all about the issue of coaching.
The second one, they were two separate questions, which is why
I know. What I'm saying is the questions that preceded these two were all directed toward the issue of coaching. And then you had these two questions, which I concede are two separate questions, but they were asked bang, bang, one right after each other, all following the questions regarding coaching. And I think they all have to be considered together. I think the question about whether or not there was any indication of dishonesty is just kind of the flip side of the question about was there any indication of coaching.
Well, a child could be dishonest for a variety of ways. Could be angry with the person who's identified as the perpetrator. There are a variety of reasons why a child might be honest.
But in this case, What I'm saying is, I mean, and you're right, I don't disagree with you at all. What I'm saying is, in this case, it was all a bundle. It was all part of the questioning of the social worker regarding indications of coaching, and then that question about dishonesty was just thrown in.
Thank you.
When we get to that question of indication of dishonesty, aren't we having at that point the witness do precisely what we expect the jurors to do? Look for objective indications of dishonesty.
I would certainly hope jurors would look for objective indications of dishonesty, yes.
Well, and isn't this then invading the province of the jury? Because if we have an expert saying, here's how to do your job, I'm going to just step in and I'm going to tell you whether you heard any indications of dishonesty, that's for the jury to decide. Krueger and Jensen were different. Those are at least one step removed from the question of honesty, right? So there's something that a reasonable juror might not know about. What does coaching look like? Well, I don't know what coaching looks like. We have an expert tell me what coaching looks like, and then I use that to determine whether there are objective indications of dishonesty. What does activity consistent with, or what is behavior consistent with sexual assault look like? I don't know what those are, so I have somebody who can tell me that, and then I use that to indicate, to determine whether there are indications of dishonesty. When we get to a point where the witness is speaking directly to whether there are indications of dishonesty, that's the ultimate job of the juror, isn't it?
May I be permitted to continue? I see
yes, the red light is on, but you certainly can answer.
To answer your question, I repeat my answer to the Chief Justice's question, which is I think that in this case, you have to consider the question on dishonesty to be related to the question on coaching. But in any event, I most certainly do not concede that the issue of whether a child who claims to have been sexually assaulted is being honest or dishonest is something that the jury can necessarily determine. I cited in my reply brief four articles that I found on the internet relating to, is a child telling the truth? This tells me that that issue is not one that even mothers can clearly decide when they're deciding whether their own child is telling the truth or not, much less whether a jury can tell that about someone else's child that they don't even know. Now, we don't have a good foundation in this case. I mean, even Judge Posner would not go with popsugar.com as a source of reliable information. But I'm not willing to concede that jurors can actually tell in every case whether a child is telling the truth or not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Megan Sanders-Drazen, and I represent Stanley Mayday. I want to start with one of the last questions that was asked, which is, can you rule in this case that one of the social workers' answers was impermissible and one was permissible? But I want to preface my comments about the differences between the dishonesty testimony and the coaching testimony with a more fundamental point. There's a tendency to push the limits of evidentiary rules in cases about child sexual assault, and that tendency is understandable and justifiable. But the rule remains that one witness cannot vouch for the credibility of another witness. That rule hasn't, to this point, been questioned. Jensen and Krieger admit testimony that, as Justice Kelly put it, tiptoe up to the line of vouching, but aren't quite there. And I would say in this case, you have the opportunity to continue to hold that line, to continue to hold that a witness cannot vouch for the credibility of another witness.
Do you think that it's possible that one of these statements is closer to the line than the other?
Absolutely, yes. And that brings me to the first point I want to make.
For the reason.
Say that again?
And you can incorporate this however you want and whatever your response is. For the reason, perhaps, as I do, that coaching involves a third-party actor. and it doesn't necessarily involve a lot. Someone can be coached in the non... Someone can be coached to tell the truth. Tell the truth, tell the truth. Whereas, did you see any signs of dishonesty seems to run far, far more closer to the question of veracity or truthfulness. So would you please address that issue?
Absolutely. I think everything you just said is correct. Attorney Balistrieri at one point said that we all agree that the statements here are close to the line. And I would say I definitely disagree with that statement. I think one of the pieces of testimony at issue in this case, the testimony about dishonesty, is patently over the line. It's a clear violation of Hazeltine because it is specifically about dishonesty. I think the coaching testimony admittedly does come closer to the line. I think in some cases, coaching testimony could be proper for the reason you alluded to, which is that coaching, objective manifestations of coaching, if you will, have to do with an influence from outside, a third party. A third party has had an impact on a child, and that impact might manifest itself in a way that a juror might not know about, and an expert witness can clarify what those objective manifestations might be for the jury so that the jury can come to a more accurate conclusion about the child's credibility. The same is not true for the dishonesty testimony, for an expert witness's testimony about dishonesty generally. We believe in our legal system that the jury is the best arbiter of who's telling the truth. We leave that decision to the jury. That is fundamental in a jury trial. It's up to the jury to decide who's telling the truth. And I would point out just quickly that that is even more important in a case like this, which, as you put it, Justice Bradley, is a he said, she said. This is not a case where there's any DNA or medical evidence. There are no other witnesses to the crime. There's no independent evidence whatsoever corroborating this child's allegations. And in a case that comes down to two stories, two competing stories, we have to let the victim and the defendant tell their stories and let the jury decide who's telling the truth.
Do you think it makes a difference in this case that the social worker's testimony about indications of dishonesty was in the context of her interview of the child, and the jury actually had the opportunity to evaluate the credibility of the child who testified at the trial? Does that make a difference here?
Short answer, no. I think the fact that the jury was able to independently view the child's testimony both in court and in the video is all the more reason that we should let the jury do their job and assess the credibility of the child. I think whether they had viewed the video or viewed the testimony live in court or not, the point is that they have that capacity on their own, and having an expert, frankly, it doesn't just have to, it's the whole patina of expertise issue is sort of beside the point because it can be a lay witness as well. To have a third party come in and give their opinion about the credibility of the child invites the jury to defer to that third party. And I think here, as you said, they had the ability to view the testimony on their own. Nevertheless, that the social worker's testimony invited them to defer to the social worker's perspective on the child's credibility, and that was important.
Counselor, is it possible that there are indications of dishonesty with which a reasonable juror might not be familiar?
Is it possible? I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I will just remind you that we believe in our legal system that the jury is the best determiner of credibility. And in every case that involves witnesses testifying, we allow the jury, in fact, we demand, our constitutional framework demands, that the jury makes up their mind about who's telling the truth. And
so, but if an expert were to come in, and let's change up the facts just a wee little bit here, an expert were to come in and say, well, here are some indications of dishonesty you might want to look for when you're assessing the testimony of this child, would that be appropriate?
Did you ask whether it's all right for someone to just come in and talk about indications of dishonesty?
Yes.
Without the the next step of, and this child does or does not display them, or this is my opinion as the child's
dishonesty? Yes.
I would say no. I would say, once again, dishonesty is credibility, is lying, is truthfulness. All of those things are, we trust juries to be able to assess them on their own. Granted, there are things, there are issues that bear on credibility, such as coaching, such as the Jensen-type testimony where we're saying this behavior is or isn't consistent with how an assault victim will behave. Those things are related to credibility, but credibility, that final question of credibility, is for the jury.
That may be true, but these other factors relate, and they may not be within the experience of a juror. For example, most people think if you delay in reporting being assaulted, probably lying, because most people think that you just race over to the cops and get to 9/11 immediately, whereas there are indicia in our experience that explain not true. And the jury won't know those unless they are told that. So your statement about credibility is not, and I think this goes to Justice Kelly's comments and questions, there are factors that an ordinary lay person would think mean dishonesty or think mean truthfulness, mm-hmm. when our experience and evidence say no. And that's why you need an expert witness. If you don't have those factors, then you shouldn't have an expert witness, right? Because under ordinary conditions, you don't have one witness say the other one's lying. Mm-hmm. But if there are extraordinary factors that people generally don't know, then you can say these are the indicia of truthfulness on the basis of evidence-based practices or research. And she does or doesn't fit it. But what was missing in this case is the objective criteria. Mm-hmm. And so the question is asked, does it fit? Is there indicia? And you answer yes or no, but you have no foundation. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the problem in this case?
I think that is the fundamental problem with the coaching testimony. Mm-hmm. There was a comment about the coaching testimony that I wanted to touch on, that Attorney Ballas.
I would not know when there is coaching, by the way.
Say that again?
I don't know
right.
about what are the indicia of coaching.
Absolutely.
Counsel, if I may, just for clarification, the question right above coaching speaks of coaching, not just any old coaching, you know, sit up straight at the witness stand and make sure you speak in the microphone. It is specific kind of coaching. It is coaching to continue a
False allegations.
So we're not talking about any
yes.
kind of coaching. So with that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
My point.
And I think your point is correct. And to his statement that we have a rule of evidence that allows experts to opine without providing the basis for their opinion, I would say that there's also a rule of evidence that expert testimony is only admissible if it assists the trier of fact. And that's the question here. Does this assist the trier of fact, or does it simply invade the province of the jury by making credibility determinations for them? And as far as the coaching testimony is concerned, I think the reason coaching testimony theoretically can assist the trier of fact is what you were saying. We don't know necessarily what the signs of coaching are. We need to be taught, we need to be educated about what those signs of coaching are. And perhaps we'll find those signs to be probative, perhaps we won't. But once we know what they are and learn from the expert whether or not this child displays them, then we can use that information to come to our own determinations about credibility. Without any foundation about what the signs of coaching are, a simple statement that this child isn't displaying those signs conveys to the jury the impression of the social worker that she hasn't been coached to give false allegations, which is to say she's telling the truth. it's a take-it-or-leave-it statement, right? So we need information so we can assess the probative value of an expert's testimony rather than a conclusion that we, without any background information, are forced to either accept or reject entirely as the jury.
But your position would be, though, if the testimony is about indicia of dishonesty, even if you listed out what those indicia were, that would be inappropriate, and it would continue to be inappropriate if the expert were to testify about whether she saw any of those indicia, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But we allow expert testimony with respect to whether behavior is consistent with sexual assault because the reasonable juror is not necessarily going to know what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's at least the possibility that the reasonable juror wouldn't understand all of the indicia of dishonesty. I mean, there are poker players in Las Vegas that have made careers out of being able to tell whether someone's lying better than I can, right? And
so I've heard.
So wouldn't it be potentially helpful to a jury to hear what are the things I ought to look for in assessing a person's credibility?
I suppose, to me, this sort of brings us back to the Daubert question of whether there is, I mean, to be clear, this isn't a Daubert case, and the Daubert question is sort of off to the side here. But is there good science? Are there good facts and data that you can base an opinion about credibility on? I certainly don't know of any. The record in this case certainly doesn't reveal any. We have, you know, the evidentiary rule that we don't accept polygraph evidence in courts. That reflects our distrust of the science that's out there about signs of dishonesty or honesty. So I would say, in theory, maybe one day we will have science on credibility that can be introduced via expert testimony and can influence a jury without invading their fact-finding capacity. I'm skeptical of that, but I would concede that it's possible. I will say there's no evidence that science exists right now. But again, that Daubert question, I think, is a bit off to the side.
Counsel, this is ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And as we all know, Strickland has a two-part test, deficient performance and prejudice. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that there is deficient performance in failing to object or failing to grasp the import of the question. What kind of prejudice is there?
Thank you. I think prejudice here, again, brings me back to the point that this was a pure credibility contest. And insofar as you accept that the testimony from the social worker was improper because it was essentially testimony about the credibility of the witness, it was testimony that bolstered the child's story that formed the entire basis of this case and this conviction. And in this situation, various cases have looked at prejudice or harmless error in a similar situation, pure credibility contest, vouching testimony, and have determined, as I think you should hear, that that is prejudicial, that the admission of that sort of testimony that conveys to the jury an expert's opinion about the child's credibility is prejudicial because it's tipping the scale to one side or the other in a case that is just two competing stories. And it should be up to the jury on their own to determine who's telling the truth.
Counsel, on page 4 of your brief, you have three questions and answers listed.
Page 4 of which brief? Pardon me?
The response brief.
That's the blue brief.
Mr. Mayday's brief. So let's assume for the moment that we decide that third question crosses the line.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any indication that KZL was not being honest during her interview with you? Answer, no. Is it your position that those 15 words are sufficient prejudice that we would need to scotch the entire trial?
Yes, it is. And I think what I want to remind you of is the prosecutor's closing argument. Were this the only 15 words, I would still consider it prejudicial. But it's not only these 15 words. It's also the way the prosecutor wove these 15 words is it really 15 words? I have no idea. But wove those words into her closing argument. She referenced, and this is in my brief as well, she referenced this evidence and told the jury, you got to hear from a social worker who was specially trained to conduct these interviews. She told you that there was nothing that she saw that indicated that the child was lying. Okay? She brought it back to that testimony so the jury didn't forget. And lest there be any confusion about what those questions were intended to convey to the jury, she specifically informed the jury. Those questions demonstrated that the social worker thought the child was telling the truth. That is effectively what that testimony meant, and that is brought home by the prosecutor's closing argument. And we're not discussing it because I will admit it's a secondary issue in this case, but this is all the more apparent when you look at the irrelevant evidence about Mr. Mayday's weapons training that was admitted. And the prosecutor relied on that evidence, that testimony, in her closing argument as well, to portray Mr. Mayday as a dangerous person to explain why the child didn't come forward with the story. In both cases, the evidence came in, and it shouldn't have, and it was prejudicial in and of itself when it came in. And then prejudice was underscored by the prosecutor's closing argument. And if I can, while I'm on the topic of the irrelevant evidence, I just very briefly want to remark upon an argument that was made in Attorney Ballastieri's reply brief, which is that this evidence, in fact, portrayed Mr. Mayday as a good person of good character because it showed he'd been trained and was a prison guard and those sorts of things. And I would just note that the trial attorney's job is to tell a story with the evidence in the record. And very often, a single piece of evidence will be relied upon by both the prosecutor and the defense attorney to bolster their respective factual narratives. And so what matters is less the content of the evidence and more how it's used by the attorney. And in this case, undoubtedly, it was used to portray Mr. Mayday as scary to explain why the child didn't immediately report the alleged assaults. And given that use of the testimony, I think it's clear that it did not make Mr. Mayday look good and that it was, in fact, prejudicial. In the context of the other errors, prejudice, I think, is clear. I'm going to just touch a little bit more on coaching testimony, since I have a little bit of time. I think coaching testimony is the most interesting issue in this case because it's the issue that this court hasn't yet ruled on. And it's the issue that takes case law that's been developed on vouching, Hazeltine, Jensen, to the next level, Krueger. And I think if this court decides to dive into coaching testimony, which, might I add, it doesn't have to do in this case, because that final question about dishonesty was not about coaching and was vouching and would in and of itself support an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. If it decides to tackle coaching and to tackle what is required to develop proper coaching testimony, I think a few points should be kept in mind. And I'd say these points come through in Judge Brown's concurrence in Krieger, which is that prosecutors, this doesn't constrain prosecutors. Not being allowed to elicit vouching testimony does not constrain prosecutors. They can ask questions about the signs of coaching. They can ask questions about whether the particular child is displaying those signs. They just can't cross the Hazeltine line. And Attorney Ballastieri requested that you draw that line clearly in this case. And I would submit that the line has already been drawn clearly. And that insofar as coaching testimony is concerned, what you're going to be doing is reaffirming that line, not drawing it anew. And the point is, with coaching, in order to assist the trier of fact, that foundation has to come in first, the predicate, if you will, has to come in first. Otherwise, it amounts to vouching. It's tantamount to vouching. And so as the case law suggests...
I just want to make sure I understand your thought.
Uh-huh.
When discussing an interview, the interviewer can talk about proper interview techniques.
Yes.
And as part of that, the interviewer would talk about the kinds of things the interviewer would look for in the person being interviewed, right?
The kind of things she would look for as signs of coaching or that sort
of thing? Coaching or dishonesty.
Sure.
Okay. And then the interviewer would have to stop and say nothing else about how, whether this witness reflected any of those things that she's required to look for.
That is not quite my position. So if questions are given to the social worker about what the signs of coaching are, the social worker can go one step further and say this child does or does not display those signs. Similar to Jensen's testimony, this child's behavior is or is not consistent with the behavior of children, similarly situated children, victims of the same crime. Can compare and contrast the behavior, whether it's about coaching or about being a victim, but can't give her express opinion that this child has or has not been coached, is or is not telling the truth. That's where we cross the line.
Because she said there was no indication that she'd been coached.
So in this case, the reason that we've crossed the line is because there was no foundation that coaching, that conclusion about coaching, the purpose and effect of that conclusion about coaching was to vouch for the child's credibility. If we're looking at just the form of the question about coaching, were there any indications of coaching, I have no problem with that had it been preceded by testimony about the signs of coaching. The next question I do have a problem with because it asks about dishonesty.
What's the next question?
Well, it talks about whether there was any indication that she was not being honest.
And there was a somewhat recent opinion by this court, I believe it was called Cleaser, where this court made very clear that you don't have to say, I believe that X is telling the truth. You don't have to explicitly vouch in order for your testimony to constitute impermissible vouching. What matters is the purpose and effect of the testimony.
So would you feel the same way if this interviewer didn't engage in any inquiries or didn't have any experience in the indicia of coaching or honesty? I mean, would you agree that that just shouldn't go before the jury at all?
If it were
the opposite and it helped you, you would not want to ask that question either?
So regardless of whether the testimony helps or hurts a defendant in a particular case, I think it's fundamentally important that we leave credibility determinations for
I don't so disagree
I would,
with you.
And so I would not accept that sort of testimony, even if it were beneficial to my client in a particular case. I think it's problematic. Would I be bringing the case before this court? Obviously not. But yes, I think regardless of who it's meant to help, it's problematic. And clearly, the case I just referenced was that
unreliable,
case.
If you have a completely unreliable interviewer, then you can't cross-examine and tell the jury how unreliable that interview technique was?
You certainly can. You ask questions about the interview technique. You ask questions about the person, the interviewer's experience and qualifications and what went wrong in this particular interview. That seems to me a separate question, and I would say absolutely you can do that.
That's attacking the testimony.
Well, it's attacking whether or not that person assessed their honesty and assessed their whether they were coached. If the person never assessed it, you would say there's a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I would. And I suppose I agree with you on that, and I'm not sure how that fits into this case.
Because it's difficult to say you can use it in one context but not another.
I don't see what I'm saying you can't use and what you're saying you can use. I'm not seeing those as the same. Perhaps I'm not following, but
what I hear you saying is you can talk about the interview techniques, you can talk about what's proper to do with respect to an interview, but the person who conducted the interview can't button that up and say whether those kinds of things were present in the interview.
So, once again, I think a social worker can say that a child that she interviewed or he interviewed does or does not display signs of coaching. I think that is permissible. I do not think a social worker can say, I believe this child was coached. And really what I'm doing right now is just echoing Krieger. My position is essentially that Krieger's analysis of coaching testimony is sound.
But the difference here is this question relates to the indicia, not whether the question relates to whether this person believed this child.
Absolutely.
That's where I'm missing you a little bit.
So I once again, I think that there's nothing wrong with the form of the question about coaching. Asking whether you observe signs, indications of coaching, that is proper. What is improper is asking that question without first laying the foundation. And so insofar as the coaching testimony is concerned, my problem here is not with the question itself, it's with the absence of foundation.
Because if there's no foundation, then it looks as if you are testifying as to what the coaching happened or didn't happen. That's
absolutely
what you mean, that is what you hear when you say indicia. That's your position.
Absolutely. I'd say that's the common sense way to look at that testimony when there's no background information provided.
What was missing from this expert's testimony then?
What the signs of coaching are.
But tell me what,
the
trained and experienced and conducts a lot of interviews.
Absolutely.
And does
so
this regularly.
So they qualify her as an expert, but they did not get illicit testimony about what signs of coaching she looks for. And footnote 10 in Krieger addresses some of these signs. To give you just a few examples, when a child uses language that is not developmentally appropriate, when a child can't provide peripheral details about the assault, those are examples of things, of red flags that a social worker might look for when assessing coaching, when assessing whether a child has been coached. And she didn't bring those to the jury's attention. So when she said, I saw no indications of coaching, the jury had no idea what that meant. What are these signs that you didn't see? And that, again, that's where I have a problem with the testimony, not the form of the question. I agree with you that asking about indications of coaching in and of itself, there's nothing wrong with that question. It's the context in which the question was asked that's problematic.
And you're saying, let me just be clear, is it wrong to ask if there were indications of honesty?
Yes.
No matter
what. My analysis of the coaching testimony and the dishonesty testimony, I understand I addressed it in my brief in one section. Perhaps that wasn't the clearest way to do it. I think that the analysis of those two statements should be different. I think you cannot, under any circumstances, testify to honesty, dishonesty, truthfulness, untruthfulness, credibility. I think you can, when you provide the proper foundation, testify to signs of coaching. Returning to Justice Gableman's point, because that's manifesting an external influence upon the child. You're testifying to objective manifestations, some external influence. Credibility is, there's nothing causing you from the outside to be credible or incredible. That's, you know, that's something that I suppose you could say internal to the witness.
If the social worker says that research-based evidence is that just because there's delay in reporting, that does not equate to dishonesty, right?
Jensen-type testimony?
Pardon me?
Are you talking about Jensen-type testimony?
Talking about general testimony of sexual assault. That the
okay.
Delay in reporting does not equate to honesty. That's
right.
What the evidence shows.
Yeah.
And the expert can testify to that.
Yes.
And can testify that in this case, there was delay. And there were the factors relating to delay. And then say that the conduct was consistent with sexual assault victims from delay in reporting.
Yes.
That's all permissible?
I believe so, if I heard you correctly.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Light. It's on counsel. We will
Thank
have
you.
Rebuttal. I don't know where our trustee Marshall is, but she may show up soon. If not, I can look at my computer and get you started at, according to my computer, 247.
All right, thank you. I have tried to steer away from the issue of prejudice, even though this is an effective assistance case, because I really want the court to decide this case on the merits. We need guidance. I'm begging you, give us some guidance on when we can introduce this kind of testimony from people who interview child victims and when we can't. But as long as the issue of prejudice has been brought up, I will make a comment that I kind of repeat a comment in this context that I made in addressing a question that was asked by Justice Bradley, and that is, we cannot oversimplify the question of prejudice. Prejudice requires that there's a reasonable probability of a different result at the trial. What the defendant has to show prejudice, is at least there's a reasonable probability that at the trial, as it was conducted in this case, there's a reasonable probability that the jury abdicated its function as the sole finder of credibility and instead simply adopted the opinion of some kind of an expert. That's an oversimplification. There are too many factors that enter into the question of prejudice to say there's prejudice just because we have an expert opinion and just because this is a he said, she said credibility case. We have to look at, again, as I said before in addressing your question, Justice Bradley, we have to look at the question of who the witness is. What are the qualifications of the expert witness? A jury is more likely to buy an opinion of some experts than other experts. We look at have to look at what the expert said. Was it whether or not I believe that this witness, that the child is telling the truth, or was it something a little more fuzzy, like we have in this case?
Is your analysis of prejudice impacted by the context of the social worker's question? I'm going back to the question I asked defense counsel, because the social worker's testimony came in the context of her interview of the child, and the child testified at trial, so the jury had the firsthand opportunity to assess the witness.
I was just about to say that.
Sorry to anticipate your argument, but maybe I saved you time.
It was a very fortuitous interruption, because I was just about to say that. Yeah, that's also something you have to consider in assessing prejudice, is what did the social worker's testimony relate to? Was it just the interview? Was it the trial? And did the jury have an opportunity to decide for themselves?
But we only have one thing to look at here, don't we? And that's the child's testimony. It might be different, perhaps, if there were corroborating evidence. And we could say, well, perhaps there was a wee bit of bolstering to the credibility consequent upon this testimony. But there's all of this other evidence that demonstrates.
That's another factor we would have to look at in other cases. We don't have it in this case. We don't have any DNA testimony. We don't have any eyewitness
testimony. Right. So everything turns on whether the child is telling the truth or not.
No. Everything turns on whether there's a reasonable probability that the jury abdicated its function to decide whether the child was telling the truth and whether it simply adopted the opinion of the expert.
How do we determine that when there is one piece of evidence, the child's testimony?
By looking at all of these things that I've just said. You have to look at the nature of the expert, the nature of the testimony. What did it relate to? Did the jury have its own opportunity to make its own credibility determination? How likely was it that the jury is going to buy the testimony of this particular expert in these particular circumstances? You can't say that just because this is a credibility issue and exclusively a credibility issue, and because you have an expert commenting on the credibility issue, that the jury's going to buy that. That's just not true.
Okay. So in order to measure the relative impact of this testimony, let's say we decide that it should not have been and that there was error in not objecting to it. Do we need to, the seven of us, do we need to look at all of the evidence of the trial and make an independent analysis of whether that question inserted sufficient prejudice into the proceedings that we can no longer be certain the same result would occur, would have occurred without this testimony?
Okay, this is what I would like you to do. And this is the position I took in my brief. I maintain this position. I think this case should be decided on deficient performance. I think this case should be decided on the issue of whether defense counsel had any reason to object to this testimony, that he did not have any reason to object because this was not vouched. If we do get to the question of prejudice, then, yeah, you have to look at the whole record to see what the circumstances were. Was it likely? Would it be, is there a reasonable probability that the result would have been different if these questions had not been asked? You have to look at that if you decide that this was vouching.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank
counsel.
You.
I thank you both for very, very good arguments, very interesting case. The court will meet immediately in closed conference, and we are adjourned.